Blog Talk Radio.
The information discussed during the show is not intended to diagnose, treat, prevent, or cure any condition. If your pet is currently experiencing any medical issues, please seek immediate assistance from a licensed veterinarian.
Good morning. This is Dr. Caroline O'Sullivan, and you are listening to Holistic Pet Care with Dr. O. I hope everyone's had a great week, and I am very excited about our guest today. And our topic is so important, and we're blessed that we have our guest here today. So I want to go over some housekeeping here. First of all, I want to thank Sylvia Global Media Company Media Network for making this possible in the first place. Secondly, I'd like our listeners to give us a call, 347-215-6138. If you can't get through, go ahead and, for our podcast listeners, email your questions to listeners@sylviaglobal.com. And now that I've actually gone to social media, we've got some other choices. You can like us on Facebook. I'm sorry, my throat is a little bit dry today. At Holistic Pet Care with Dr. O. You can follow us on Twitter, Dr. O DVM, and get a hold of us any way you'd like about this show or any other questions. Now, today we are blessed to have Master Sergeant John Roscom joining us and speaking to us about his experiences with the Dogs of War. Now, the Dogs of War title may seem a little bit brash to some of our listeners, but it is just a truism that we have our canine friends that help us in so many modalities, both here and abroad. And my friend Roscoe, Master Sergeant John Roscom, is going to tell us all about his personal experiences with these canines, both professionally trained and not, and the skill sets that they bring forward for our military folks. I want to start by saying that I've got the utmost respect for our service men and women and our two-legged and four service, our two and four-legged service members, and I know myself that I could never do the job that you do, and I appreciate it. So with that, John, would you like to introduce yourself to the world?
Sure. Hello, world. As Dr. O said, thank you for the introduction. John Roscom. I've been in the United States Air Force for a little over 18 years. I'm an explosive ordnance disposal technician. I'm a master badge wearer. What that means in English is I'm the guy who goes out and defuses bombs, puts on the bomb suit, works on IEDs, things of that nature. I am not a canine handler, which we'll discuss in depth here today, but I do have a vast amount of experience with military working dogs, or MWDs as they're called. I have several combat tours working with military working dogs and alongside them and their handler, as well as I can't even count the number of stateside missions working for the Secret Service in conjunction with military working dogs, and then stateside helping the canine handlers train their dogs in explosives. Where better than to get their explosives from than the EOD guys who work with explosives daily. So we'll provide them hide explosive things of that nature, and we get into that a little bit, to help the dogs learn and train how to and where to smell explosives. It's not just a send the dog into the room and they find stuff. You actually have to, you know, just like training the sit, you have to train them how to find things. And some of that is not necessarily for public information, but I'll keep it clean for the world topic. So my other experiences, I worked with a 501c rescue group in Las Vegas for about 3 years.
Right.
Don't know the exact number, but literally hundreds of dogs rescued. It's called Colossal Canine Care. We primarily emphasize ourselves in a large breed, but of course, you know, as a rescue group, we wouldn't turn anybody away. It seemed at times we actually had more small dogs than we did big dogs. But
True.
Yes.
True.
It is true. There's not a whole lot of people that actually go out of the way to rescue big dogs, but since that particular group, all of us were, I'll say, in quotations, like-minded with big dogs,
yeah.
we kind of all just kind of got together and developed that. So, but,
yeah, right.
That's a little bit about me. Like I said, not a canine handler. I'm a bomb technician. So my experiences with military working dogs are from a joint effort, not as the handler directing the dog. So,
well, that's so important, isn't it? Because it's not as though you're pigeonholed into one service or one duty or one, not one skill set, but a job with a dog, that you have this vast experience with different organizations, different, you know, I guess, arms of the service and different skill sets these dogs have. Now, one of the things that you said that actually just sent chills right up my spine was the training of the explosive detection dogs. And I know for myself, I don't know if you remember Roscoe, my dog Hope, she was a trained detection dog for corrections departments, and she would do things like cell phones, tattoo ink, narcotics, firearms, cigarette, you know, anything that was contraband in her field. But her risk in going into her job every day was not explosive.
It was minimal.
Literally speaking, it was minimal. So actually, it just, wow, that just really sunk home with me there, Roscoe. That's actually quite scary. So many times I find that with what I do as a hyper-civilian, that people have a tendency to underestimate the skill set and the potential for their canine friends, and whether that's the ones that are sitting on our couches or for me, right, Mullen, sleeping at my seat, bored to death already this morning, or the dogs that do things like whether it's doing showing or agility or those types of things, and we think that that's as far as they go, or we just don't push them, or we don't think outside the box. The skill set that the dogs that you've been exposed to and had experience with, both trained and natural, I guess we could say,
right,
things that they just did in your presence and while you were abroad, you go ahead and you pick how we're going to approach this, because you have so much vital information that I know that people don't know except for mass media about a little bit, but there, or
okay,
they think it's all local, because what it is that you've done and experienced and the skill set that these dogs have is beyond my scope. So decide where you're going to start, Roscoe, and just educate us.
Sure, let's start with training a little bit. So, again, I'll reiterate, my experiences come from the user side of a canine, not as the handler side, but as a user and doing this for the last 18 years, I'm, you know, again, very knowledgeable in the fact that we work with them quite regularly. It's a hand-in-hand relationship. So as far as training goes, you know, the handlers themselves are responsible for the training of the canines and their well-being and their upkeep and their health and all that. So you would go, everything that would go into having a normal family pet. Different services handle their dogs a little bit differently. They're all, you know, kind of come out of the same, I'll say, contract, if you will, or close to the same contract. There may be one or two bloodlines that are different, what have you, irrelevant. But as Dr. O touched on earlier, some dogs are, as you all know, more apt to a certain training technique or a certain training style. Where the government purchases their dogs from, they have a training facility, and the dogs get trained, and some just don't fit the bill, and some fit it better. You know, some dogs are better at being police dogs. Some dogs are better at being what I call single purpose, or like I said, explosives only.
Right.
The Marine Corps handles a lot of dogs that are single purpose, explosives only. And that just goes into the dog's natural abilities, what they like to do, what they're going to do, how they're going to respond to a given stimuli from the handler, or you know, whatever it happens to be. You know, training is a big part of the dog's life. They get trained regularly, just like any other military person is. In fact, a military working dog is considered military. Most of them carry rank the ones that are police dogs, at least I can say for sure in the Air Force, they actually have a badge. They're
yes,
a sergeant.
Yes, yes,
yeah.
Yes.
And, you know, so one, you know, off topic here real quick, but abuse to one of those military working dogs is just as serious as it is to abuse to another military member. So,
Roscoe, I'm so glad you brought that up, because when did canines get rank in the military? Do you recall? Because when my dog here stateside, she had her badge and she was a police officer. No doubt whatsoever about that. She's a police officer, and hurting her, touching her, doing something to her was assault on a police officer, which carries felony charges here. So it's no messing around. There's no mistake that these guys are police officers, and for what you do, you're saying that these guys, thankfully, are their military ranked personnel. Is that, and so
yeah, they're military members.
Very, very nice. Very, very nice. I like that very much.
As far as when the military or whichever service branch adopted the military rank structure for the canines, I'm not exactly sure. We could probably Google it. But you know, that I don't know off the top of my head. I just know that working with them, and you know, you see some of the dogs that come through, and from some of my combat experience, you know, that the dog is wearing a badge, it's wearing a rank, it's a sergeant, it's at least an NCO usually, and you know, they've earned it. If you've actually been there and seen what these animals go through daily, you know, you could definitely say they've earned their place in that rank. It's not like, I hate to say it's not a real rank, but it doesn't take a rank spot away from any canine handlers. It's more or less positional authority for that animal, so that it gives the handler, you know, reinforces the handler's respect for the animal. The UCMJ has a specific article, in fact, involving abuse to animals. Article 134 is abusing a public animal. So if anybody does, you know, negatively abuse this animal, one of the canines, you know, Article 134 of the UCMJ is a punishable offense. And then as a supervisor, you know, I could go through and give them 92, which is failure to obey. I could give them a 93, it's cruelty and maltreatment. If they did it in combat, I could give them a 99, which I believe is misbehavior before the enemy. You know, it's just one of those things that helps individuals reinforce the fact that they need to respect the animals as much as they respect each other.
Do you ever find in your experience that that's an issue at all?
In my experience. No, not in my experience. Normally, anybody that has a slight hindrance to abusing an animal is vetted out of the, I'll say, system prior to being allowed to be a handler. Any of the guys who are handlers are normally, they're looked at pretty heavily by leadership to ensure that they're the right people for the job. You know, you definitely don't want somebody in there that's going to abuse the animal or tease them and make them vicious and mean. You know, and every once in a while, dogs are dogs. We all know dogs are dogs. They're just like people. We have a bad day. And one of the main ways that dogs show they had a bad day is they growl, or they bite, or they snap. You know, tail up, happy. Tail down, fear. You know, we all know that. So it just, you know, when you, in my opinion, when you train a dog to be a police dog, you also have to be on your guard that, you know, if you're poking or fun, or if you got to get to know that animal like you would know your own family, so that you know that the look on their face is the, hey, I'm not ready to work yet, or hey, I'm ready to go ahead and go. That's just my opinion. A lot of the dogs will be muzzled, especially if we're in a public venue. For instance, I'll say again, with working for the Secret Service, a lot of the dogs will be muzzled just so that, because people always want to come up and pet the doggy. Even though it says, don't pet me, I'm a working dog, stay back, people always want to come up and pet the doggy. And the doggies aren't always people persons, you know what I mean?
Yes.
So sometimes they'll be muzzled. It's humorous to see one of the other agents walk up to the doggy, wanting to pet the doggy that's muzzled and thinks it's no big deal, but then he gets, and I'll say, nut checked by the dog, which always turns into a humorous event for us, because then the agent is embarrassed. I mean, it happens, but there's only, you know as well as I do, there's only so much you can do to keep a 50-pound dog at bay, much less a 200-pound dog like my Corky.
That's,
So
that's what I was thinking, Roscoe, because we both have gone through, you know, 200 pounds or more in our history,
yeah.
And having people, these are civilian dogs, having people walk up to 200 pounds of teeth and going, you know, and oh, look, cute little dog, and you're like, you know what? Do you think I can actually control this dog? I mean, really? I mean, look at him. He's, you know, he's a huge.
Yeah.
Well, hey, but he's having a bad day, or he's this, or he's that. It doesn't make sense. But with the dogs that you're talking about, and with my limited experience with the police dog, police canine, first of all, in my, like I said, my limited experience, these dogs with their handlers, they are partners. They have that. They are a team, and that holds certain rights and privileges and those types of things.
Correct.
And commitments to each other. And then, like you said, having these dogs muzzled, you know, there's a certain group of people that think that oh my gosh, help me, you know, this, that, and everything. And the thing is, if you know what you're doing and you're able to pant and you're able to function, it's just as much security for the person that's going to go, oh, cute doggy, than it is for the dog as well, just in case they're having a bad day. Or their skill set demands that they are on watch, on call, all the time. So having a stranger approach your handler or approach something, or if they smell weird or their posture is weird or any of the things that dogs know and we don't, they're going to be on duty, on service. Their job never ends, just like the armed forces, just like the police officers, just like first responders, their job never ends. So, you know, a word to the wise and a word to every listener, ask first, don't approach them, have some respect for these guys, both two-legged and four, and ask. Ask nicely, and then if nothing else, walk away and just be honored that you were in their, you know, you were in their sphere, that you actually got a chance to see these guys, because the stuff that our military, both two- and four-legged, their skill sets are something that I don't think us civilians will ever understand. So don't, you know, doggy in the window is not what we got going on here. So do not.
Right, you got to remember they're not a dog at that point, you know, as far as I'm concerned and the handler is concerned. They're a team member. They're a member of the service. They're a team member, so. You know, they'd be like coming up to me and trying to pet me. That's really not going to go over so well, you know?
I'm sorry. I wish our listening audience had a visual of you because you are a formidable creature, my friend, and the idea of petting you.
Now, if you've got food in your hand, maybe I'll let you pet me, but...
I'm going to have that image with me for a long, long time. Thank you, Roscoe.
Well,
so,
you're
back
very welcome.
To our dogs.
So, when it comes to training, you know, some of the dogs have a tendency to be more single purpose. Like I said earlier, with the Marine Corps has a lot of single purpose dogs they'll use as explosives only dogs. A lot of those end up being Golden Retrievers or Labs, and they will not be police dogs. So the benefit to that is you can sit with them in a combat or tactical vehicle. You don't have to worry about them biting you because they're not trained as police dogs. They're trained to find a particular type of odor. You mentioned with Daphne, she's trained to find a particular odor scent or skill set of odors that, you know, cell phones or ink. She wasn't trained as a police dog. Some of the dogs don't do well as explosives or scent dogs. They do better as police dogs. And then you've got your guys that I call dual purpose. They're very good at both being on command, on leash, off leash as a police dog, and they're very good at finding odors, whether it is drugs, paraphernalia, or certain kinds of dirt and vegetables coming through customs, or whether it's explosives as I would utilize that kind of animal in a combat situation. So one of my many deployments, you know, we were in tactical vehicles. As an Air Force EOD tech, we're a force enabler. So the Marine Corps, not everybody that's dismounted or mounted doing combat missions, always has an EOD team with them. But their job is to go out and clear a route. We'll call them a route clearance team. That's the name. Let's say they come across a particular area that doesn't really give the team leader a good feeling. So they'll they have a couple of things they can do. They can send scouts out. They can send, you know, an element to go look around the area. They can send a vehicle. If they have the canine with them, the canine unit, one thing that they can do is they can send the dog up off leash and see if he happens to, you know, react to any kind of odors in the area. In Afghanistan, it was a very good tool to use. I don't remember this particular dog's name. It was a golden retriever, and it was a, you know, Marine Corps handled animal, and he was really good. He was really good at what he did, and you know, he thought he could get a little dog time. He could scratch his ears. It was okay to do that as long as he wasn't on the job. When we were back at the FOB, or what we call the Forward Operating Base, or the COP, which is a combat outpost, when we were back there and out of the vehicles and the dog got some water and food and was, you know, relaxed, then, yeah, you can scratch his ears, you know, for me, getting a little dog time in. But when we were out on patrol, you know, dog's on mission, he's working, you know, you don't mess with him because now he's distracted. Just like a child would be distracted, you know, the popular advertised saying that the dogs never get mature more than a 2 or 3 year old. So, you know, some of our dogs, I'm sure, don't even make it that far. Some of them maybe a little bit further. But
so Roscoe, can you give us a visual of that?
Imagine you're in a imagine you're in a semi truck that's all armored. Not necessarily a semi-truck, but a big-ass truck. And you've got a bunch of guys with you and all their big-ass trucks. And you come across this curve. Well, in that curve, you might say, oh, you know what? I can't see around it. Before I risk, you know, these multi-million-dollar vehicles and the life of my individuals to go around the corner, let's go ahead and send a patrol out and see if we can see if there's an IED buried in the road or improvised explosive device. Which is kind of what we combated when we were in Afghanistan besides insurgents. So one of the tactics that we would use, we'd take the canine handler and the canine out, and he would send them up, and sometimes he was spot on, could find something right in the road that we couldn't even see. And then at that point, you're like, okay, now it's suspicious. At that point, I take over as the explosives ordnance disposal team, and, you know, we go in and defeat the IED. The job of the dog is to find, you know, and they're fast. They, you know, dogs are fast. They can run up. They can sniff around. The canine handler can use a series of clicks and whistles or, you know, sometimes they'll have a radio-controlled collar that he can speak to the dog, and the dog will hear what he's saying and can direct them left or right.
That's interesting. That's very interesting.
So you can do it from remote, right?
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so
when you hear a radio-controlled collar, I always think about shock collars, and I'm like, well, you
don't
want to do that. Talking about they can talk to each other. They can talk to each other. That's interesting.
Well,
sorry to bother you.
It's more one-way conversation. If the dog talks back, it's usually just in a bark.
So
you can direct the animal. you can direct them to go down a road or down a wadi, which is like a little river canal. You can direct them to stand up to an individual that's there, so you can have them sit and stare down. So you can have, you know, it's just one of those things, an extra tool in our toolbox to use. And if the dog doesn't find anything, you know, it's one of those level of confidence of the dog. You look at the handler, and the handler knows his dog better than anybody, and he says, hey, he didn't smell anything or find anything, and then we continue on around the corner. Or we'll send a dismounted patrol up to verify. You know, it's always one of those trust but verify, and we'll continue on about our mission. So, you know, that was we used him quite often. He was really good. The only, you know, bad part comes into when there's other dogs, wild Afghan dogs in the area, because they're wild. They kind of like picture them as like a gang member sometimes. When they pack up quite easily, like a pack of wolves or a pack of coyotes, so, you know, one military working dog doesn't really stand a chance, and neither do a whole lot of soldiers. You know, sometimes the only thing you can do to defend yourself against a pack of wild Afghan dogs was to use deadly force.
Because
they don't listen to stop, or even if you say stop and posh to, they don't listen to that. They keep coming because they've been abused by the locals and they're hungry. And
yeah,
they
yeah.
know
so
that,
they're wild animals, and you're talking about
right,
wild
they're
animals.
Wild animals at that point. Sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll say most of the time when they've packed up, they can be. Now, there are the occasional good Afghani dogs. I had the experience of being fully dismounted for a portion of one of my deployments. And by fully dismounted...
Roscoe, what does that mean? Roscoe, what does that mean?
Well,
dismounted? Does
fully
that mean
dismounted.
Walking?
Correct. Fully dismounted means
okay.
that I have no vehicle whatsoever in my inventory. I have boots on my feet and whatever I can carry on my back and my chest and my weapons and my team members. That's what fully dismounted means, like no vehicles whatsoever. So,
thank you.
We also had a canine handler temporarily that was with us for a while on that particular mission while I was with the Bravo Company of the 82nd Airborne. Awesome group of dudes, you know, and they had a canine handler with them on occasion. And sometimes we would go out. See, again, I'm the guy who responds to a bomb or a threat or a situation. I'm not really the go out and finder. You know, the 82nd
okay,
Airborne,
great.
The patrols, those are the guys that go out and find. So they would take the canine out, and most of the time, canine leads the way, and they would find things. And then at that point, like, hey, EOD, we think we found something. Why don't you come on, check it out? We'll go check it out. And so most of the time, if the canine verified it, that, yeah, you know, he alerted to whatever alert, whether they lay down or sit or roll over or start telling
right.
jokes, you know, that was supposed to be funny. But whatever the canine does to say, hey, there's something here that I'm familiar with. This is what I've been trained to smell. And
right.
We'll go up, and sure enough, most of the time, almost every single time, it was accurate. There was something there, or more than one something, you know. And then when he went away, we had always had this dog in the area, and we called him Bravo. He was a wild Afghan hound, and not like an Afghan hound like you would Google and see a nice, pretty, long, slinky Afghan hound. He was a dirty, bare-boned, pirate gang member Afghan dog. If you type in Afghan dog in Google, you know, and just look for a wild Afghan dog, it's just kind of use your imagination of a dirty, beefy, no frill, scars on his face. You know, this dog had been abused by the locals. We named him Bravo because we were at the Bravo Company, and I say we as in the whole group. Now, the military
right.
doesn't condone adopting stray animals, so we didn't adopt the animal. We didn't let it into our compound, but it was there. And every time these guys left for a patrol, as long as the military working dog wasn't with them, Bravo
right.
would go on patrol with these guys every single time, like without a doubt. And we didn't feed him. You know, we don't know if one of the locals owned the dog, but we're pretty positive he was wild, had no collar, nothing like that, because they don't really have collars on the dogs over there. And he wasn't ever pinned or chained up. Very agile, could climb 10-foot walls like crazy.
Wow.
Better than some of the
wow.
soldiers could, which was pretty awesome. So Bravo would go on patrols with us. And, you know, like I said, he was abused by the locals. We saw a couple of scars on him. Because, you know, I'm kind of informally trained by Dr. O to look at animals. You know, I'd watch her work, so I learned a few things by watching her work on my dogs and other dogs. And, you know, he had a few scars that one or two appeared to be bullet wounds. It wouldn't be from a U.S. weapon. It would be from a one of the insurgents' weapons because of the size of the entry and exit wound. One was in his leg, but it didn't seem to bother him. Another, he had a big scar on his chest, which I'm assuming was from, who knows, from being beaten or from razor wire or something. But Bravo would go on patrol with us, and oftentimes we would come up to a local national, you know, a native-born Afghani or someone that was there in a man dress, and Bravo would sprint ahead of our group, pin him up against a tree or into a corner or against a wall, and by pin him up, I mean kind of sit there and stare at him in the eyes. And Bravo was a male. He was
uh-huh.
probably easily 80 pounds, so a big Afghani
dog. Oh, wow.
Dog.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
easily 80 pounds and no fat, you know, just all slender muscle. And, you know, by pin him up, I don't mean like, you know, Scooby-Doo style, hands on his shoulders. I mean just sitting there a foot away as the individual scooted backwards, Bravo would scoot forward, then we would pass,
yeah.
and Bravo would shift his body as we passed, shift so that it was him between us and the, you know, possible insurgent or local national, and he would stare him down until he thought that we were well enough away, and then he'd catch back up. And he'd
right,
do his
right.
thing.
Isn't that,
isn't that amazing?
Amazing.
Yeah, you know, we didn't train him. He just kind of did it. So, you know, I guess I'll say again, the military didn't condone his actions. We didn't take him on as a pet or as
right.
a, you know, adopt him or anything. He just kind of was always there outside
right.
the gates of our compound. And when we went on patrol, he was there. You know, and when
yeah,
it was time
thing,
for him to disappear, he kind of just...
The behavior that you described with him, Roscoe, is much like the, you know, the police dogs when you hold a suspect or those types of things and you sit there and it's a non-contact posture, but there's no doubt whatsoever that you are not going to move. You're going to stay there while I'm sitting here right in front of you, and if you move, I'm going to follow you, or, you know, you're not getting away. And I don't know how many of our listeners have ever gotten a stare down by a dog, or a dog that actually means business and actually makes, you know, that does that wonderful when they kind of just lock their eyes on you and don't blink. And there's no doubt
yeah.
whatsoever that this canine means business and is not going anywhere until it chooses to leave. So that skill set, that drive, the, you know, the drives and traits of dogs, which many people don't have a great appreciation for, that makes them so wonderful at these different jobs or skills or inherent drives. You know, you're describing Bravo doing the things that we find so wonderful with, you know, civilian police forces, having these dogs, you know, we think that they're trained to do it, but knowing that they have to have some sort of internal drive, something inside of them that makes them want to do it or know that it's right or know that I'm
right.
protecting these people against this person. And, you know, I guess our listeners can be like, well, how the hell would they know? But therein lies the question for a lot of canine behaviors.
Yeah.
They're so wonderful. It's like, wow. That's what it does. It just makes you stop and go, did you see that? That was amazing. You know, so
well,
I know
one more
it's
quick
not science,
story about
but,
Bravo.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Oh, one more
go
quick
ahead,
story
no,
about
I,
Bravo. We were on another patrol, and as I mentioned about the wild Afghan dogs, sometimes the only way to protect ourselves against the wild Afghan dogs was the use of deadly force.
Right.
You know, we happened to be traversing through this particular, I'll call it an area, and there was a dog chained up, and the dog broke the chain and started coming after our patrol. Well, you know, immediately the nearest soldier raises his weapon, and Bravo, we didn't know he was with us. He was sneaking around doing his thing. We'd seen him, and then, like I said, he disappeared when he wanted to come back around. One
right.
of the dogs broke, and this is a big dog. This is probably a 120-pound dog. Easily. It was very tall, probably at least 3 feet at the shoulders. I mean, it was the size
wow.
of a mastiff. It was a very
wow.
large,
wow.
white, fluffy, brown-spotted, white, fluffy, big-ass dog. Well, one of the soldiers raised his weapon, and I saw out of the corner of my eye, I saw a flash of brown and black streak between our formation, and because we were looking over there at this, and it was probably, let's call it 50 yards away. When it broke leash, because we, you know, we tried to respect the landowner. We stayed off of his property, and we stayed out of the land. Well, the dog broke the small chain or whatever he was on, and Bravo came sprinting to our formation, and this is no crap. Bravo went out there, met the dog at full speed. They did, like, this spin thing. Bravo grabbed him by the throat, and the dog was dead in, like, 10 seconds.
No,
and then
no,
he,
sir.
Yep.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Wow. Wow. Good. I mean, good news, bad news, right? I mean, that kind of brings up mixed emotions for me, but holy smokes. Somebody comes out of nowhere and just killed this
just,
dog that was coming after you
just
guys?
Just protected us. Came out of nowhere and just protected us. He was. We knew he was with our formation. We were on our way to an IED site because I was with the company, and... You know, we were traversing some of the terrain. Like I said, we were staying off of this landowner because we knew that this dog was there. And,
yeah.
you know, later, of course, the captain went up and apologized to the landowner. Did, you know, because the dog, everybody knew at this point that this dog was with the U.S. They knew that it wasn't a U.S. dog, obviously. But the locals
right.
that we, KLE or key leader engagement with, they knew that we had a dog that followed us around. They didn't know where the dog came from. And, you know, so they knew about the dog, but The landowner understood. He knew that it was going to be us or the dog anyways, and it just so happened that Bravo took care of business. It's actually kind of crazy. We still talk about it. Some of the guys I was deployed with, we talk every now and then. It'll come up like, hey, man, how your dog doing? Hey, man, you remember that time that Bravo got that Afghani hound? And we're just like, yeah, man, that's still crazy. I still talk about it. Still, you know, unless you're there and picture him going past you at 30 miles an hour and meeting this dog that was about twice his size head on, like I said, they scuffled for a minute. Not even a minute. They scuffled for a second, and within 10 seconds, Bravo had him by the throat, probably because he was able to get underneath him because he was a little taller.
Yeah.
Get underneath him, had him by the throat, and the dog was on the ground down. Two of the soldiers went up to check it out, and sure enough, that dog was gone. Bravo had a little bit of blood on him. He had a scratch on his back, and that was about it. Yeah, that was about halfway through, and then, of course, that story spread, and, you know, then the veterinarian wants to come out and put all the dogs down in the area, and you're like, oh, okay, well, he's not here anymore. We're like, you know what, this dog is an asset to us. We're not just letting him go. You know, we're not condoning or adopting him, but we're not letting him go, you know?
Yeah, he protected you guys. You know, I mean, he did a military service. Without being asked, without being trained, he helped to protect you guys. How do you let him go? You know, how would you let something like that, something bad happen to this dog that wanted to protect you guys? I mean, no way.
Again, we didn't feed him. We didn't take him in. We have no idea where he learned to do anything. He was just a wild gang member pirate dog that, you know, we didn't abuse him, so he loved us, I guess. There's really no explanation for it. We have no idea, you know. So I would probably call him a good single-purpose dog. He was there to protect and serve, and, you know, he probably is up in doggy heaven at this point. But, you know, he was a great dog. Yeah. It would have been awesome if somebody could have got him as a pet, but, you know, that probably wasn't going to happen for that particular animal.
Right.
You know, not all the Afghan hounds that wild are bad. A lot of them are good. I helped with a few of the guys. Again, military doesn't condone adopting an animal, but ones that did, maybe got their commander to approve that, yes, they were able to keep an animal around, because that is a possibility. There are veterinarians in the area. Maybe the animal got its shot so that the commander was allowed to keep it around. Allow the individual to keep it around. And there's a few times, you know, I helped the individuals figure out what it was they needed to do. There was three guys, two soldiers and a Marine, figure out what it was they had to do as far as getting the shots, the proper paperwork to bring that puppy back home stateside that they rescued from certain death. I was with the Marine Corps with that first dog that I talked about, the single purpose explosives only dog. There was a group of puppies. Well, all the puppies perished except for one puppy, and we think it was the mother that killed them, and they named the puppy Bullet because the mother was, you know, we had to take over this compound. The mother had to bite the bullet because she was attacking several of the Marines when they entered the compound. And then the one puppy that was left over, you know, they named the puppy Bullet. It was a good puppy. I actually have video of this little puppy. He was a cute little dude. I made him a little collar. Just because we're in the compound, the dog's in the compound. What are you going to do, right? He's already there.
Yeah,
he's going
to take care
there.
Of him. He's a cute little puppy in the middle of some uncool stuff. I know.
Right.
I know what I would be doing.
It's a puppy, you know.
I know what I would
It's not like we adopted it. I made a collar for it out of some 550 cord I had laying around just so that, you know, we could keep it away from, you know, so we could keep it away from our dog. And one of the Marines, you know, went back to that area that made a cop out of a combat outpost, and of course the dog hung around, and I helped him with the paperwork and the stuff to get bullets back stateside. And I think I don't even want to say that I think I know where he's. I want to say, well, he's either East Coast or West Coast. I don't remember where he went back to, but that dog Bullet made it back to the States, which was pretty cool.
Right on.
And then two of the soldiers that had officially adopted, you know, through permission from their commander, had brought back two dogs. So I already had the, you know, because there's certain things you got to do. You got to get the vet check. You got to get all the permission stuff. You have to you know, work with the government in order to get the dog back across the border, stuff like that. You know, you have to pay the fees and the fines and all the crap. So, you know, it costs a little bit of money to bring a wild dog, one of those wild dogs, back to the States. But, you know, the last I heard from any of those guys, it turned out to be a really good experience, even though it cost them upwards of $2,500 to $3,000 a piece for each dog to bring back. So, but
you know what, Ross? I got
to
be honest with you. It's not like we haven't spent that kind of money on our dogs anyway. So, and then what a wonderful story that is, right? I mean, what a wonderful story.
Yeah.
You get a small fluffy into your area, and I can't speak for you guys at all, but it must have brought some smiles and some joys and some fun into something that must have sucked. And then you get, somebody cares enough to figure out a way to get this puppy safe, hopefully forever, and stateside, and jumps through the hoops and kind of just stands up and makes it happen. How awesome is that? So, saving that little dude's
life.
That's
pretty cool.
That's really cool. That is just, what a great story that is. But
the soldiers in the Marine were very appreciative of the help I was able to offer them, which I'll say I learned through my work with Colossal and my work with you, Dr. O, figuring out what to do. And then, of course, they have to fly. So, I had a couple of people I knew mail out some flying kennels, airline kennels.
Yes.
Yep.
Great.
So
yeah.
I had a friend or two back in Las Vegas mail me out a flying kennel that I carried to the guys so that they could have it and fly the pooch back stateside. So,
You pulled out all the stops in all the countries and got all the equipment for little small fluffy bullet, which is, that's just standard delivered. That's such a great, wonderful story. Now, with regard to your service dogs, your military dogs, your MWDs, military working dogs, I'm not very good with acronyms, so I apologize for that.
Yeah.
That's okay. You had a lot of experience, like you said in the beginning of the show, about the Secret Service canines and training the dogs to send out explosives, I'm guessing, and that you had a hand in training the Secret Service humans, with regard to the materials and those types of things. Now, the Secret Service handlers of these canines were akin to the Marines and such that had the canines that were detection dogs, and then at that point, these dogs would probably passive alert, and then EOD goes in and defeats these ordnance, whether they're here, local, or abroad. Is that pretty much the way it works?
In a nutshell, it depends on the particular mission. Working with the Secret Service, it's a different mission than working on a military installation. As a bomb technician working with the Secret Service, my mission is a little bit different. I'm not there as an IED defeat person. I'm there as a finder. That was like about the only person or the only time that we go out and find things. Because who better to find things than the guys that know what the bomb members are thinking to the best of our ability and where they would be hiding things of that nature. The dog is just another tool in the tool bag that we utilize to help us search, if you will. As far as the training goes, they're allowed small amounts of explosives, the canine handlers. So when it comes to larger amounts, we'll help them with the larger amounts of explosives so the dogs don't get sensory overload. And I'll say a bit of a funny, you smell, somebody farts in a room, 10 seconds later, you don't smell the fart anymore because you have sensory overload. But if somebody new walked in the room, they're like, hey, who farted? Same thing with explosives and dogs. once they get sensory overload, they don't smell it anymore.
Thank you, Roscoe. That's awesome. Yeah.
they get sensory overload. They don't smell the explosives anymore. So we'll help them with larger quantities, with the training. We'll help the handlers hide things to where they might not think that it'd be a good place to hide things. Just because, again, we're the explosives defeat experts, and they're more of the handlers. It's a team effort. We're all a team effort. So, if I can do something to help my tools sharpen up, then of course that's what I'm going to do. And for me, the canine itself is a tool in my toolbox to help me verify or, pinpoint that there is something there call it a hazardous situation, and we'll go down and take care of business. So
I can't imagine what kind of understatement that just was. A hazardous situation, you'll go take care of it. You know, the risk and the skill set that you have, and you know, and that what it is that you do for the safety of this country and every single person around you. I can't give it enough respect. If you had a couple minutes to tell our listeners about the importance of canines in the military, just as a broad strokes, and because okay. I know from personal experience that people in general, especially folks like myself, are hyper civilians. We read stories, or we hear in the media, or we have some wonderful Trident Canine Warrior and those types of things about the Navy SEAL dogs, and we see the extraordinary things, you know, the kind of wow things. But with regard to having the ability to have a canine with you or with your unit, or you know, having a hammer there, what would you tell our listening audience is the importance of the ramifications of having canine skills when you are on duty or when you're deployed and those types of things?
Okay, well, Dr. O, like I mentioned earlier, there for me and my intentions, a canine unit or the dog itself is more of a force enabler. You know, like I said, I trust but verify. So if the canine alerts to something, a particular area of the ground while I'm in Afghanistan or in another combat environment, or while stateside, if it alerts to a couch or a plant, you know, trust that he or she found something that they've detected. And then, of course, you know, my job is to go in and verify that either there's a device there or there might just be something that's throwing the dog off. You know, take out the human factor. But as far as the importance, you know, it depends on how they're utilized, just like any other tool. What's the importance of a tire on your car? Well, we can get away without tires. We can make it all out of wood. But how would it work? How much better would that vehicle function, you know, if your tool isn't sharpened? And that's the big thing. It comes back to training. You know, you've got to have the canine handler and the canine unit trained, working synchronously, working together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Working together to on the task at hand, you know, and the public isn't really going to see the dog so much working, although they may be there. And part of the reason for that is, just like I said earlier, they're children. You know, do children get distracted in malls? Hell yes. Do dogs get distracted when there's a lot of people around? Hell yes.
Yeah.
So in order to keep the dog on task and the handler on task, and then not to mention, too, you know, if the enemy or the insurgents or the bad guys, we'll call them, happen to be watching, we don't want them watching our tactics. So
Do you know what the time course is on training these dogs? I mean, are we talking?
To be honest with you, no, and it's not quite that far. A lot of the times, the dogs that the services get, I believe, are under a year old. They could be a year and a half, but I'm not really sure how long it takes a dog to go from what's called green or a newbie to being ready for action to deployment to a location. That again, we could Google. I could ask one of my buddies. I hadn't thought about that question at all. I know it's not that long. I will say I know it's several months, but it's not a year. It's not that long.
And I'd imagine that these guys are constantly they're constantly being tuned up, you know, constantly being refreshed, constantly being,
right.
you know, a new experience. And just like anybody else that is training for anything, whether it's athletic
right.
or your brain or whatever, you got to keep things tuned up, keep things fresh. Don't get bored. Don't get burnt out. Don't get overstimulated. Don't, you know, those types of things. There's so much that goes along with the canine philosophy and with the drives and the trains and such. But what you're saying is that, you know, you come in, you know, maybe purpose-bred dogs, they wash out of, you know, or they pass with flying colors when the people are doing training decide if they're up for the task, and then they go into training,
right.
and then they go out to service with their handlers. Now, these dogs, with your experience, they stay with one handler just like a police officer would stay with one partner for the most, you know.
No, no, and this is my own personal thing. I mean, I believe that they should. However, the U.S. government doesn't have the same, you know, theory. Most of the time, when a base acquires a group of canines, they stay at that base. So if the individual handler moves to another location, they get a new dog when they get there, and dog A stays with base A. Handler B goes on to base B, and they, you know, they hug it out, lick on the face, and that's the last time they see each other. And there's different theories behind that. So, you know, the canines themselves, like I said, in the AOR, the area responsibility, they deploy as much as the handlers do. So if I've got a handler and he's working with this particular dog, they deploy for a rotation. The dog will come back for 6 months and maybe deploy again, but he'll deploy with a different handler. So the theory that, like, let's say the Air Force, because I'm in the Air Force, has is that they want the dog to be more versatile with more different people. Again, my own personal thing is I wish that they would say, okay, well, this is you and your dog, and you and your dog are going to work with each other till the, you know, till either one of you gets out of the service or the dog is no longer serviceable as a military member. But they don't do it that way. I don't know a lot, all the branches, but in the Air Force, the base that acquires the animal, it stays at that location throughout its career.
Isn't that interesting? It's interesting.
Yeah, it's because the government wants a more versatile animal, so that animal can deploy more. It can deploy within another 6 months or a year, and maybe the handler won't deploy because, you know, things always come up. So let's just say, you know, and it makes good sense the way to do it. So if the animal and the handler deploy, come back, and all of a sudden now the handler, let's say it's a female, is pregnant, and it's time for the dog to deploy again. Well, obviously that female isn't going to deploy. So now, in order to still have a canine that's deployable, you know, you have to have a different handler.
Right.
The male, male breaks his leg or has some sort of medical condition or whatever, and he can't deploy, but we still need the dog to be in theater doing this canine thing. We need another handler to go. So it's a versatility thing.
Yeah, and the thing is that's the word, right? I mean, you got to, you know, the versatility of all members is important. And then just like, you know, my experience with you is that one day you're doing one thing, and the next day you're doing another thing, and then you got the word you're not doing that thing, and then you got to be ready to build your, and then you get orders that you're moving or orders that you're doing this, you're going here, going there, and the unpredictability of and your need to be able to adapt is important, I'm guessing.
Right.
And that's the same with the canine, I'm guessing, is that he or she's got a job to do, and as long as they can do it well with a good handler, that they need to go. You know, it's time to go to work.
Right. And they usually do really well. They usually keep them pretty versatile. Even though there may be one primary handler at a location, I believe, speaking with my buddies, that they normally get out and work the dogs, as in all of them, so that they maintain that, okay, so now this guy's working with me today, or okay, this girl's working with me today. So they see the different people, and if they're accustomed to working with different individuals at different times, that they're themselves not locked into one person.
The thing is, it's surprising when you first said it, because I'm so used to, you know, one dog, one person, lifetime commitment, I retire, you retire, those types of things. But I guess that's a very comfortable civilian way of looking at things, where the jobs that I do every single day pale in comparison to the jobs that you do every day. So I'm humbled. Thank you. Honestly humbled, but it makes sense, right? Because everybody
right.
that's in the military has a job to do 24/7, and that when the call comes in, you just adapt and overcome. Is that those the right words? That was a difficult one for me to swallow, because my dogs are the fluffy lay on the couch dogs, not the go to work and try to come home safe.
And also,
so
keep in mind that your dogs are your dogs. These dogs are military members.
Oh, yes.
So
Very good point.
Right. So then the handler also doesn't get the thing that's, oh, hey, this is my dog. Like, no, that's a sergeant in the Air Force. You know, he's a military member.
That's like somebody coming up and trying to pet you, right? It's like,
right,
no,
yeah, somebody trying
no,
to pet me.
Don't do that.
I'm probably,
do
yeah.
Just don't do that. Yeah, I, you know, here's my rank, here are my stripes. Don't do that, you silly, silly civilian. I love it. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So
well, I've
had
nothing but positive experiences with the military working dogs. You know, of course, I've had dogs my whole life, so I know that if one of the MWDs is looking at me and he's not liking what he sees, you know, I'm going to walk away, which is pretty rare for me because, as you know, most dogs that I've ever approached, even your, you know, less than optimally adoptable ones that we've rescued, they've
yeah.
all at
yeah.
least let me pet them and touch them and come up to them, even though they wouldn't let anybody else, which, you know, me and you always thought was rather odd, but who knows, maybe I was a dog in a previous life.
Maybe you were
that.
A big dog. Maybe you were a big dog in a previous life.
Yeah,
a big dog,
probably.
I'm thinking, yeah.
Saber-tooth dog, yeah. But,
okay.
you know, I've always had positive experiences with them, and, you know, they've always been really good at what they do, and the handlers themselves have always been really good at what they do. And, you know, I've got nothing negative to say about any of the working dogs, either Secret Service or military that I've worked with. They've all been very good at what they do, and, you know, I hold a lot of respect for those guys because it's a lot easier to work with a partner who you can speak to and say, hey, I need you to go do this. But when you have to point and snap or, you know, give basic commands to somebody and you're hoping and expecting them to sniff over there or do whatever, you know, it's a lot harder to do, you know, as well, you know, when you're training a dog or working with a dog, they don't really respond the same way humans do. So it's, you know, you have to be multilingual when you're working with dogs. It's a bit of a challenge sometimes, you know, and then they can't always just say, hey, I hurt my foot, you know.
Right,
you
right,
have
right.
To
well,
watch
your point is
the
well
symptoms,
taken,
so.
Roscoe, and that community. You have to have two, you know, I can ask you to do something, I can tell you to do something, and then my canine partner, we have to have a different kind of language. But I want to make
right.
sure that everyone who's listening today knows that this isn't the same as me being ticked off at my dog because it didn't go outside to go potty. These are life and death decisions, life and death actions, life and death detections, life and death force enabler duties that these animals are doing to save the lives of not only themselves, but of their, you know, their human soldiers in situations that us civilians, honestly, I can't even imagine that we can understand the intensity of these situations. So the information that Roscoe's brought us today comes from a place that I can only speak for myself that I'll never be there. And that the amount of service, the amount of commitment, the amount of information, the amount of stress, the amount of danger that you guys, two-legged and four, are in as a living, as a calling, is something, like I said, I can't give you enough humbling respect for what you do and the information that you brought to us and the listening audience today. And I want to thank you so much, Roscoe, and not only as a master sergeant and a skill set that blows my mind, but as a friend and as a dog lover, I love you, man. You're just the best.
I love you too, Dr. Well, I wish we were closer together and we could hang out more often.
I know. Wait till I get my next Charlie, and I'll just come knock on your door. Now, for our listening audience, it'll happen. This live broadcast will be rebroadcast a couple times this week. I'd really like everyone to spread the word to all of their friends, their family, their coworker, everybody they know to come to blogtalkradio.com/SylviaGlobal and click on this archived edition and listen to it over and over and over again. This is so important, the work that our military is doing, both two-legged and four, and the amount of skill set that they have. So, once again, thank you, Roscoe. You're the best. You honestly are the best.
You're very welcome. I appreciate appreciate being on your show. If any of your listeners have any questions to email you, feel free to forward them to me, and I'll reply back with the best answer I can right away.
Oh, yeah, that's such a great idea. All right. So get a hold of us, Facebook, holistic pet care with Dr. O, Twitter us a question, Dr. ODVM, and thank you very much for listening, and thank you very much for Sylvia Global Media Network for making this happen. Roscoe, you have an awesome day, and I'll talk to you soon, okay?
You too, Dr. O. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Thank you very much, and thank you for everyone that's listening, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.